Welcome to the Making Sense podcast. This is Sam Harris. I released my second conversation with Rory Stewart last week. Many of you found that frustrating. I understand, especially if you are listening to it after more recent events in the UK have unfolded, where even the Prime Minister had to give a speech about the pervasive problem of Islamism and jihadism in the UK, and how they could no longer tolerate it. Anyway, make of that conversation what you will. I won't further comment on it here, but I am confident that the topic will come up again and again and again. Today I'm speaking with Brett Stevens. Brett is an opinion columnist for the New York Times. He previously served as editor-in-chief of the Jerusalem Post, and as foreign affairs columnist for the Wall Street Journal, for which he won a 2013 Pulitzer Prize for commentary. Among his other distinctions, in 2022, he was banned for life by the government of Russia and can't visit that country ever again. And we talk about Russia, among other things. We discuss America's place in the world, the waning Pax Americana, American isolationism, Republican fondness for Putin, Tucker Carlson, why America should support Ukraine, the significance of Alexei Navalny, what it would mean to properly hold Putin responsible for his death, nuclear blackmail, valid criticisms of Israel, the war in Gaza, Palestinian public opinion, the need for total military defeat of Hamas, the prospects of a two-state solution, the isolation of Israel at the UN and the International Criminal Court of Justice, waning support for the war in the Biden administration, Hezbollah and war with Iran, Israeli politics and the settlements in the West Bank, charges of settler colonialism, anti-Semitism as a series of double standards, the prospect of a Trump victory, Biden's age problem, the crisis at the southern border, U.S. immigration policy, and other topics. We cover a lot of ground here. And now I bring you Brett Stevens. I am back with Brett Stevens. Brett, thanks for joining me.
It's good to be on the show, Sam.
So there's not much going on in the world. It's too bad we don't have anything to talk about. How's the weather in New York?
Yeah, it's a quiet time of peace on earth. So the weather is just fine. It's warming up.
It really is. I don't know if this is an illusion, but it seems like history is being made at an increasing pace here. Everything seems to be accelerating, and this year promises to be, unfortunately, not at all boring. I've been gathering topics to talk to you about when we originally scheduled this a couple of weeks ago. I've been just watching the news and writing down topics, and they sort of fall into five buckets, and we'll see if we get through each of them. But I'll just preview them for you, and then I'll lead you into the first. The first is the waning Pax Americana, American isolationism, and the inclination among Republicans to abdicate U.S. leadership in the world. Tucker Carlson as a font of wisdom, etc. The second, which is kind of contiguous with that, is Russia and the war in Ukraine. The third is the Middle East, the war in Gaza and Iran and related matters. The fourth is the presidential election, the trouble with Joe Biden. At one point, you made a charitable case for Trump in your column for the New York Times.
Well, that was a thought experiment, just for the record.
We'll be clear about that. Yes, this was a bending over backwards to take those who are still inclined to vote for Trump seriously, insofar as that's possible. And then finally, I thought we could touch on the crisis at the southern border and our immigration policy, if you have anything to say on that topic.
So topics I write about a lot.
Great. So number one, so this new feeling of American isolationism, I've said previously on the podcast, it would be one thing to argue for a different posture for America with respect to being the world's cop or maintaining the rules-based international order. And I think we can readily argue against that. But the Republicans seem to have gone further, and they've actually become fans of autocracy in various forms, and certainly fans of Putin, And then you have someone like Tucker Carlson, who many people take seriously as a maverick journalist who's uncovering the real deal over there in Russia. How do you view what's happening here with respect to American leadership? And then we will turn that toward Russia and Ukraine afterwards.
You know, someone once said to me that there's a smart version of wrong and a dumb version of wrong. Mm. And when it comes to Ukraine, the smart version of wrong is the argument that we can't possibly hope to bring Ukraine into a Western sphere of influence when, for the Russians, it's so core to the way they have seen themselves historically that our energies have to be husbanded to deal with our principal threats, and our principal threat is China, and we would be better served pushing Ukraine into some kind of negotiated settlement with Russia so that we can deal more forcefully with the threat that the Chinese pose to our position and our alliances in the Far East. That's the smart version of wrong. It's wrong because I think that if Ukraine is going to fall, then we will have to actually devote more resources to the defense of Europe, not fewer resources. It will be a NATO country that will next be in the crosshairs, and we will have treaty obligations. And it's wrong because I think the collapse of Ukraine, and or rather the collapse of Western and American will to support Ukraine, is just going to serve as an advertisement to Xi Jinping and China to adopt an even more aggressive posture in Taiwan. But at least that position has the merit of an attempt to sort of think strategically about what our options are when we have limited resources.
Mm.
The Republican Party now is in the dumb version of wrong. Not even the dumb version of wrong, I would say the evil version of wrong. Because what they are doing is abandoning an extraordinarily courageous Democratic ally that has done us the service, the great strategic service of destroying about half the Russian military without the loss of a single American or NATO soldier. And against a dictatorship that, as we just saw with the killing, really the murder of Navalny, whether he was murdered in this last instance or so sort of just slowly put to death, embodies the most despicable, malevolent features of Soviet totalitarianism that the Republican Party used to stand against. So it's ignominious what the Republicans are proposing, but it's also ignominious and stupid because ultimately an America that abandons its allies, an America that thinks that our oceans are moats, is going to come to the same painful discovery that our great-grandfathers had 80 years ago, more than 80 years ago, when they realized that our oceans are not moats and that we are vulnerable to attack and that we will be attacked because we are ultimately the great democratic power and a source of a target for dictatorships everywhere. So the Republican Party has really descended below just simply bad strategic thinking into something that looks like the head in the sand, know-nothing isolationism that brought us to the brink of disaster back in the late 30s and early 40s.
Mm. Well, I know I've asked you some version of this question more or less every time we've spoken, and I imagine there really isn't an answer for it, but I'm going to give it another go because it is the inscrutable object and moral horror at the center of this thing on the right politically in America now, which is just how did we get here? I mean, you know many of these Republicans. I mean, you speak privately with them, presumably. I don't know if you still do. I mean, many are former colleagues. Many are very serious people or erstwhile serious people.
Ex-friends.
Yeah. But I mean, there are people who you know who have like real bona fides, as many of them as intellectuals. Some are like were or you know, may yet aspire to be serious politicians who are, for whatever reason, enthralled to the cult of Trump, presumably mostly for opportunistic reasons or reasons of political survival. But I mean, how is it that we have so many people acquiescing to what is just at best an amoral embrace of somebody like Putin? Just the list of indiscretions is so long and so obvious and so indisputable. I mean, he's someone who, you know, the very moment that Tucker Carlson is glad-handing him, you know, there's a Wall Street Journal journalist imprisoned over there, right? Yeah. And he's somebody who kills his political opponents, not just in Russia, but he kills his critics in the capitals of Europe, you know, poisoning them with polonium or nerve agents. You know, he imprisons his own billionaires, right? I mean, it's just like, how is it that the Republican Party can, even for a day, tolerate an apparent fondness for this guy, given what it used to stand for?
You know, the Republicans used to mock left liberals who would go to the Soviet Union and say, you know, people seem pretty happy there. And yeah, maybe they're a little poorer than we are, but there's more equality. They would mock, you know, the nation likes to do tours of Cuba and talk mm-hmm. about the great health service there. And it was a source of conservative derision, correctly so. The kind of naive, starry-eyed Westerner who would go to a despotic regime and take a look at the Potemkin villages that had been erected for them and say, look, you know, I've seen the future and it works, as Lincoln Stevens, a great progressive journalist from 100 years ago, famously said. And now it's the Tucker Carlsons who are doing precisely that. I mean, precisely that, going to a grocery store in a country where the gross domestic product per capita hovers around, I think, $11,000 or $12,000 a year, and seeing a showcase supermarket for the nomenklatura. So some of our listeners will understand what that term means, you know, the upper crust, mm-hmm. the upper elites of Moscow, and saying, look how much better this is than your average Stop and Shop. By the way, I doubt very much that it is, but that was what Tucker was peddling. And, you know, to answer your question, when Trump was first elected, Sam, I took some books off my shelf, which I had read in college. I got to college in 1991, which was the same year that the Soviet Union collapsed. Mm. And for some reason, I developed this kind of fascination with the anti-communist intelligentsia of the Cold War. Really, not just anti-communist, anti-totalitarian. So from Orwell and through, you know, Milosz, the great Polish mm-hmm. intellectual, Václav Havel, dissidents like Sakharov, all these people sort of thought deeply about the nature of totalitarian society. And what's fascinating about some of the best work there is it's not really a political analysis. It's a psychological analysis of what makes people succumb to ideologies that at some level they know are false and evil. And the really interesting insight, you find this in Milosz, for example, is that it's not really fear that is the motivating force. It's a kind of rationalization of the position that they're in. So it's a kind of view that, well, it's all bullshit. So why don't you just go along with the bullshit that happens to be in power? Or yes, the system is evil, but this is the direction in which history is inexorably going. And so you want to be on the right side of history. Or they're even sort of darker psychological tropes. Jean-François Revel once said that, you know, it's easy to understand why people want to tyrannize other people, but the really interesting mystery is why some people want to be tyrannized. I mean, this captures sides of the human psyche that those of us living in free societies are loath to acknowledge or see, even if we see it in some like cultures and subcultures, but it's there. And that's how people succumbed to the lure of despots, cults of personality, preposterous ideologies, kind of things that ideas that collapse in the face of a moment's thought. And yet that's what you have now in the Republican Party. And I think it's a mixture of a few things. I was in a debate recently with someone on some foreign policy questions. And the guy's argument basically came down to, well, the American people don't see it that way. And, you know, to which you want to say, well, they're mistaken. And in a free society, we should raise our voices and argue with the American people and win them over, right? That's the task of democratic persuasion. So that's sort of the argument like, well, history's not on your side and I want to be on the side of history. Or essentially like, you know, why should we have a moral component to our foreign policy. It's a dog-eat-dog, Hobbesian world. Let's just accept that that's the way it is. Well, you know, most of us actually understand that it's a better world and a smarter world when leadership contains a moral element which makes other people want to follow you and not oppose you. So that, I think you really understand something of Trumpian ideology. I'm not talking about sort of the ordinary Trump voter, but the Trump ideologues. In reading these books that came out 60 or 70 years ago about why despotism seemed to be so effective for decades on end.
Well, what to think about the war in Ukraine at this moment? I mean, we're now speaking just a handful of days after there was a recent setback there. To say that we have been dilatory in providing aid to Ukraine at this point is a bit of an understatement. There's a lot of controversy as to whether we should be aiding Ukraine as you move, certainly as you move right of center. And there's also, as you said, the recent death of Navalny, which really kind of sharpens up the moral difference between the two sides. You wrote an article recently about what it would mean to properly hold Putin responsible for Navalny's death. That might be an interesting way into this question, but tell me how you're viewing the war in Ukraine, our wavering support for it, and what you think we should do in light of who Putin is and what his intentions are and what it means to defend a struggling democracy.
Well, we should help Ukraine as much as we can, not only because of the morality of supporting an embattled democratic ally against a foe like Putin, but much more importantly, the self-interest, you know, the kind of argument that I hear on some quarters, many quarters of the right, sometimes on the left too, is, you know, morality is too expensive for foreign policy. Foreign policy is about our interests. But there is no question that the United States has an interest in seeing its one of its two most aggressive and arguably its most dangerous geopolitical rival humbled, humiliated, and defeated on the battlefield, not by us, but by our proxy. And when it comes to the question of expense, you know, someone says, well, $60 billion is a lot of money. It reminds me of a scene in one of those Austin Powers movies, you know, where the evil guy says that his ransom is $1 million. Yeah. He's like come back to life from the 50s or 60s, and everyone's like, $1 million? Like, that's nothing. So $60 billion, as large a sum as that sounds, is 1% of the federal budget. Okay, we have a $6 trillion budget. Ask yourself, is it worth spending one out of every $100 that we spend on so many other things, right, on defeating one of our two principal strategic rivals through the sacrifice and courage of our friends and partners in Ukraine? I would argue that's an incredibly great investment for the United States.
We even have a few American citizens who could single-handedly foot the bill and still have $60 billion left over after they picked up the tab.
I can think of one or two of them off the top of my head. They would be fine for the rest of their lives. But I think this is a task really for the American government and even the American taxpayer. We are more secure when Putin can no longer think that he can threaten his neighbors and ultimately our treaty allies with impunity. Now, the other aspect is comes to life with Navalny. You know, when I was coming of age, I think maybe you're a few years older than I am, Sam. Basically, we're the same generation, so we remember that names like Solzhenitsyn, Sakharov, Sharansky, Havel, Lech Walesa, the Solidarity Movement in Poland, these were household names in the West, and Navalny should be a household name not only because of the extraordinary example of moral and political courage, but actually also the power of his thinking and his prose. It is a shame he was not awarded the Nobel Peace Prize before he was murdered. But Navalny matters because he symbolizes what all free societies should stand for, which is the belief in the singular importance of individual conscience in the face of the overwhelming power of the state. That we, as members of democratic societies, should always look at those exemplars of individual conscience and dissent as models for what we in our societies try to protect. And I fear even now that within a week, the conversation about Navalny is going to be, you know, a part of the remote past. And I think that's not only a failure on our part, it says something, I think, about the degraded state of democratic discourse, but it's also a foreign policy failure. Because in standing up for people like Navalny, in punishing the regime for what it did to him, we're actually helping to embolden some unseen number of future Navalnys who could at some point profoundly threaten the state. It's not for nothing that Putin took a singular interest in Navalny and was so threatened by him, because he understood that the power of Navalny's example, his courage and his conscience, were a threat to his regime. The best thing we could do, this was suggested to me by Bill Browder, the financier and activist who was behind the Magnitsky sanctions, is what he called the Navalny Act. Russia has north of $300 billion in frozen assets in Western institutions. They were frozen after the war. We should seize them and give them to Ukraine. If the Republicans want to say it's too expensive for us to underwrite Ukraine's defense, we'll give them Russia's money and let a portion of that money go to the purchase of weapons from the West. It would be a real signal to Putin that this kind of action has devastating consequences and hits him right next to his most precious assets, right in his wallet. That would be one thing. The next thing is there's an election in Russia, a quote-unquote presidential election, next month. Gary Kasparov, the great chess player and also human rights activist, he said, just don't recognize Putin's legitimacy. That's another thing that Putin craves in addition to money. He craves the trappings of political legitimacy. Stand up for other dissidents. And let's just give the Ukrainians the weapons they've been asking for 2 years so they can start to hold Russian targets at much greater risk.
What about the concern that I haven't heard it voiced much of late, but it was certainly voiced early on in the war when we began to support Ukraine, that we're poking a nuclear tiger with a stick and perhaps not a, you know, more and more a tiger that has nothing left to lose. And so it's really the threat of nuclear blackmail here that we're being told we should acquiesce to. On some level, we can't afford to help, we meaning not just the U.S., but Europe, we can't afford to help Ukraine win, truly win here, because that would leave Putin with more or less nothing left to lose and a kind of existential threat, you know, politically and even mortally on his own side. And he might, in fact, just decide to let the big bombs fly at that point.
Well, look, Putin has been blackmailing us with nuclear threats. His sidekick, Medvedev, routinely issues these unsubtle threats. You can't ever discount the possibility that bad people with nuclear weapons might use them. On the other hand, we've lived now, Soviet Union detonated its first bomb in 1949, so we've lived with 75 years of bad guys having nuclear weapons, and they haven't used them yet. And the reasons for that turn out to be pretty good ones. Take just one side of this, Sam, which is the question of tactical nuclear weapons. People were very worried that Putin might deploy these so-called small nukes, you know, one kiloton, five kilotons. I mean, they're major, they're huge bombs, but by the standard of strategic nuclear weapons, they're relatively small. And seen from a military angle, they really don't make a lot of sense, not least because if Putin were to deploy them, A, we would know at least a week in advance because of our intelligence. I'm told this by people who know. B, the Russians would have to clear the battlefield. That is to say, they would have to retreat from the front lines if they were going to deploy one of these weapons and not incinerate their own people. So that would give us further advance notice. The third thing is they're destroying the very ground they seek to conquer, and not just destroying it, but rendering it, you know, uninhabitable for decades. And D, the Russians would need thousands of nuclear suits, you know, radioactive suits for their troops operating in the vicinity, and they just don't have them. So those are just, they add up to a very good reason not to use these bombs. These bombs were first developed and deployed with the idea of massive concentrations of Russian armor coming across very narrow, defined places in West Germany during the Cold War, where a 1 kiloton Western nuclear weapon would make sense in killing a lot of Russian troops. It doesn't work quite as well on the Ukrainian battlefield, which again doesn't make it impossible. It just makes it highly unlikely. And it's also important not to allow ourselves to be implicitly threatened by this kind of blackmail, because it, of course, it just advances Russia's war aims. I mean, Putin wants very much to win in Ukraine, but what he really doesn't want is to be completely incinerated. And someone made the point, remember during COVID when Putin would sit on one end of some 40-foot table and, you know, Macron or whoever was visiting him would sit at the end. A guy who's this afraid of COVID probably doesn't want to start a thermonuclear exchange with the West, which would be considerably worse than COVID for his own personal health.
What about the idea that he really just wants Ukraine and would be happy to stop there for, you know, reasons of the historical, you know, fictitiousness of Ukraine as a nation and its belonging to Mother Russia, and he really has no further designs on Europe? What makes the concern that there's no stopping point, or no natural stopping point, if we just let him take Ukraine, a rational one? I would imagine the Tucker Carlson camp is highly skeptical that he is going to be rolling tanks into the rest of Europe.
Look, Lithuanians who lived under the Soviet Union up until 1991, the Estonians, all the Baltic states, they have a different view and a better informed view, which is that Russia, almost by its nature, is an expansionary power. And so the argument that he's satisfied with Ukraine alone defies the long course of Russian history. So whoever would come after Putin, if he were sort of a dictator in the same vein, would then look for, let's say, softer targets, Moldova, for example, or targets to the south in the Caucasus, seeking to reconstitute the Soviet Empire. And it was observed by a historian in the 20th century that when Russia is internally weak, and it tends to be more expansionary in its aim. So there's a long history here which argues against the case that Putin is satisfied with Ukraine or a portion of Ukraine alone. It just runs against everything we know about dictatorships. I mean, the expression "drunk on power" is a cliche, but it's a good expression because power is like alcohol, and dictators are like alcoholics, and they're not satisfied with just one drink. People thought that Hitler would be satisfied with the Sudetenland, and that was the basis for the Munich Agreement in 1938, or with, you know, the Anschluss with Austria. Because, well, Austria is in a sense, you know, a German-speaking country. Then it was Poland. Then it was, you know, the Lebensraum, and so on. So I think it's just crazy to indulge this kind of thinking, particularly given that Putin's track record before Ukraine was the invasion of Georgia in 2008, various threats against European neighbors, cyber attacks on Estonia, one thing or another. This is not something that he's shown no example of having a restricted appetite in other theaters. No evidence.
Okay, well, let's move to the Middle East, where Russia has also had a malign influence in Syria and elsewhere. The war in Gaza and the perception of now much of the world that Israel has lost the moral high ground, if it ever retained it even for a second. I mean, as you know, much of the world felt that it wasn't on the high ground even on October 8th before it had done anything in response to the atrocities of October 7th, which is that was fairly bewildering. What do you make of, you can take any piece of this ghastly puzzle you want first, but I'm thinking of things like the isolation of Israel at the UN and the International Criminal Court of Justice, the waning support in the Biden administration. Perhaps we could give the most charitable construal of concern about the right-wing side of Israeli politics and settlements in the West Bank and how those things are unhelpful at best. But we've got charges of apartheid and just what seems to me a dangerous level of moral confusion on the part of many people in powers that should know better around what is happening in Israel and what Israel's strategic and really existential needs are at this point.
Yeah.
How do you view it?
Look, let's separate two forms of critique of Israel. One is a critique that Israel has deferred too long the question of Palestinian statehood, that its policies in the West Bank are wrongheaded, abusive, and ultimately self-defeating. I'm not endorsing these arguments. I'm just laying them out. And I want to stress these are legitimate arguments.
Brett, before you begin, let's just remind people that you have some direct experience in Israel. What to remind people of your tenure there?
I was editor-in-chief of the Jerusalem Post at the beginning of this century during the Second Intifada. Mm. I probably should say I'm Jewish. I spent a memorable summer as a teenager on a kibbutz, and I have family in Israel, extended family there. I try to think about it dispassionately and not through the lens of simply, religious or ethnic fellow feeling. But I should just lay my cards on the table. I think that's just journalistically honest. As I view it, what I was saying earlier is there are two forms of criticisms of Israel. Okay, one is this, what I think is mistaken but totally legitimate criticism, and I could get into the reasons why I think it's mistaken later on, about Israeli settlement policy. Bibi Netanyahu is a bad guy. The country has no sense of what is the end game vis-a-vis the Palestinians. There are some really bad characters in the government. By the way, that is very true. There's some really shit people in the Israeli government right now who should never have been in any kind of office. Okay. So let's ring fence that and say that's all perfectly legitimate. And we might add to that, I don't think Israel has a particularly clear idea of what the end game is for it in Gaza. Again, let's ring fence that criticism just for the moment. The criticism I've mainly heard coming from not just the far left, but I think people who really ought to know better, is a critique that I think has no justification, that frequently veers into rankly anti-Semitic tropes, that was accusing Israel of genocide, as you just said, when Israel was still dealing with Hamas terrorists inside of Israel on October 8th, that looks away from what happened on October 7th, looks away from the grisly and gruesome details, doesn't want to acknowledge the fact that Israeli women were raped and mutilated as a matter of policy by Hamas, wants to ignore the fact that Hamas broke a ceasefire to launch its attack. These are the people who are saying ceasefire now, never mind that there was a ceasefire on October 6th, and who will condemn Israel no matter what it does, because it doesn't think that Israel has a right to self-defense, because it doesn't think that Israel has a right to existence. This is why this side of the argument, talking about 1948, talking about the occupation as if Tel Aviv is occupied Palestinian territory, this side of the argument is the one that I've been battling with in my columns. Because this is an argument that aims for the annihilation of a sovereign member state of the United Nations, just as Vladimir Putin aims for the annihilation of Ukraine as a sovereign member state of the United Nations. And I think they have about the same moral worth. I am, like any normal human being, horrified at what happens in war. What happens in war is people die, including a lot of innocent people. But I am flabbergasted why so many people on the left ignore the fact that this war was started in the most gruesome way imaginable by Hamas, that Hamas has kept the war going, firing rockets at Israel this whole time this invasion took place, that it holds in the most appalling conditions hostages ranging in age from 1 year to north of 80 years old, and that it spent 17 years in power constructing the most elaborate and expensive set of tunnels designed precisely to put Palestinian civilians between its war machine and Israeli reprisals. That is the war crime. That is a war crime that Hamas, a dictatorship, is imposing on the Palestinian people because Hamas fighters are comfortable 150 feet underground, whereas Palestinian civilians are exposed. And that is something I never hear some of my ex-friends on the left express with any degree of dismay.
One thing you never hear, or at least I haven't heard it, is all the people who are calling for a ceasefire, why don't they call for the release of all the hostages as the precursor to the ceasefire? Why isn't that a single demand? Release all the hostages and then Israel stop your war making. Why does it ever appear in that format?
I almost never hear this expressed. And I also never hear the common sense view that the easiest way for this war to end is for Yahya Sinwar and the rest of Hamas leadership to give themselves in for a war crimes tribunal, because inarguably they are guilty of war crimes for what happened on October 7th. Hamas could end this war immediately, So the question isn't whether a tragedy is taking place in Gaza. It is. The question is the culpability for that tragedy. And I also, Sam, I'm also flabbergasted by this kind of dumb math, which says, well, 1,200 Israelis were killed on October 7th, but thousands of Palestinians. I don't trust the official numbers because they come from a Hamas-controlled ministry, which has every interest in inflating them, but let's agree there are thousands of Palestinians, multiples of the Israelis who died, and therefore, because the math, the ratios don't add up, that Israel bears the greater share of the blame. That's like arguing that, okay, about 1,000 or so, more than 1,000 American sailors were killed on Pearl Harbor, so World War II should have ended when, I don't know whether it was Doolittle's raid or the first successful American counterattack in the Second World War killed more than the number of Americans who had been killed. That's not how wars are waged. That's not how, you know, at some point, Germany lost many more people than the United States in fighting the Second World War. The moral tables didn't turn when suddenly Hitler could say, well, you've killed more Germans than we've killed Americans, so now I'm the innocent party. But that's exactly the kind of logic that you hear expressed from leaders of human rights or so-called human rights organizations, and a lot of people who really ought to know better opining on these subjects.
The reductio ad absurdum of that moral math was pointed out, I think, by Douglas Murray when he said, what we want is a truly proportionate response from the Israelis, where they go into Gaza and find an analogous music festival where they rape and torture and kill the exact same number of non-combatants as Hamas killed at the Nova Music Festival, etc. Who thinks that would be a moral norm we want to enshrine?
You're giving crazy. Me the idea for a call. And by the way, notice, it is true that Israeli soldiers, as soldiers have in every single war, have behaved badly. I have yet to hear a single case of a Palestinian woman being raped by Israelis, of people being gratuitously slaughtered, of Palestinians being found with nails and other sharp objects in their private parts. Let's look a little closely at this. Israel is fighting as every Western army has in its history. That's not to say that they are blameless. The United States was not blameless, not even in World War II, in terms of the conduct of its forces. But nothing like the barbarism that we witnessed on October 7th.
What do you think Palestinian public opinion is at this point? I mean, there have been some recent polls that purport to shine some light on it. It's always a question how many grains of salt we need to take these polls with, especially, I mean, you're asking people whether they support Hamas in a context where Hamas is the thugocracy, you know, ruling over them. But there's some responses that were somewhat suggestive of that Israel does not have as many reasonable neighbors as one would hope. I mean, for instance, you know, both in the West Bank and Gaza, people have been asked questions about whether they support what Hamas did on October 7th and do they support Hamas. And the support for the atrocities of October 7th is very well subscribed. It's like 70 or 80%, depending on where you ask the question, which is about double actual support for Hamas. So it's from my, you know, this is my, I'm a naive consumer of this poll from afar, but looking at it from where I sit, it seems like people were courageous enough to say they don't support Hamas, but they did support what Hamas did on October 7th. I guess you can always bracket that and wonder whether they have any idea what Hamas did on October 7th, because there's a fair amount of conspiracy thinking and frank delusion in Muslim communities and in every community across the world. So there, you know, there are people who think that nobody was raped and or that no non-combatants were killed, etc., or that all Israelis are combatants. But we have to think that there's a fair number of people who knows what Hamas did in all its gory detail on October 7th. And when you have crowds of people celebrating the, you know, hostages and corpses being paraded in front of them, that's one spot where you're also taking the moral temperature of a culture. It's routine to try to demarcate Hamas from the Palestinians in general. And I'm happy to stipulate that there are certainly some great number of Palestinians who are horrified by Hamas and don't want to live under them and are horrified, would be horrified by the details of October 7th if they knew them. But I also have a sense that we have a community which, for a variety of reasons, both of you, because of the occupation and the settlements and the quality of life in Gaza and in the West Bank, so and their, you know, multi-generational feelings of unrequited nationalism, all of that, they're unhappy and they're not thinking so straight. But beneath that, we have a level of religious fanaticism and fondness for jihadism and martyrology and tremendous amount of dangerous bullshit that is basically brainwashing people. So I'm just wondering how hopeful you are about the prospect of, even if we could get rid of Hamas tomorrow, right? Even if Hamas just did, they cut a deal, you know, the Israelis cut a deal and they give Hamas and all its leaders, you know, safe passage to Qatar as a way of ending this thing. And the Palestinians are now once again left to their own devices to find leadership and to find the political will to be good enough neighbors so as to warrant a two-state solution. How hopeful are you that that is possible given the nature of sentiment there and the culture?
Look, those are tough questions because polling in really totalitarian societies like Gaza under Hamas, and that's what it is. It's not authoritarian. It's totalitarian. Yeah. It tells you what you have to be on the inside, not just what you have to do on the outside. Is useless, right? Not only is it useless because people are afraid to say what they think, but it's useless because often people don't know what they think, because the nature of these societies is that you're exposed to propaganda all the time, and you become sort of confused. I mean, you occasionally will hear exceptionally courageous Palestinians. I remember a report of a Palestinian on the move from north to south of Gaza, you know, claiming or saying furtively to a reporter, you know, this was all brought on by what Hamas did. But how that opinion gels with maybe a larger set of assumptions, beliefs, it's just very hard to disentangle. What I do know, Sam, is that we have prior examples of cultures that were given very heavily over to kind of death cult leaders and to ideologies of annihilation, ethnic or religious chauvinism. I'm thinking of Japan and Germany before and during the Second World War, that were capable, demonstrated they were capable of shifting very dramatically. And the secret in both of those cases was total military defeat. So one of the reasons why I think that Israel has to persevere until Hamas is, you can't say unconditionally defeated, but very visibly and clearly defeated is that I don't think that the set of assumptions or beliefs, cultural beliefs, political beliefs that you described are going to change unless it is clear to a vast majority of Palestinians that whether they agree with those views or not about destroying Israel or the evil of the Jews or whatever, that they're a loser's game. You know, in 1973, the reason that the Yom Kippur War led in just 4 years to the Camp David Accords was that Egypt, after its initial taste of success at the beginning of the war, got its ass kicked militarily. At the war's end, the Israelis had crossed the Suez Canal, could threaten Cairo, had encircled most Egyptian forces in the desert. The Egyptians knew they were beaten. And it was the knowledge of being beaten that allowed Egypt to accept that they had to have a different attitude and relationship with their neighbor, with the Jewish state. I don't think much changes, and there's much hope for a Palestinian state, until the Palestinian fantasy of eliminating Israel, until the fantasy is destroyed. And the surest way of destroying it is by destroying the capacity of Hamas, whatever the ideology is, the capacity of Hamas ever to threaten war or inflict the kind of damage that they did, that they've done on October 7th and afterwards. So my, you know, I'm someone who favors in the long term a two-state solution, but a second state, a Palestinian state, it can't come into being if some large percentage of Palestinians basically think that the purpose of a Palestinian state is eventually to create a platform to annihilate the rest of the state of Israel, that it's simply a stage on the road to what they consider the liberation of Palestine. So there is something that is valuable about an Israeli victory, not just for Israel's peace of mind or the interests of justice or vengeance or whatever, really in the long-term interests of a peaceful settlement.
What do you think about the isolation of Israel, you know, on the world stage, in particular at the UN, and the signs of waning support from the Biden administration? I mean, what do you think is going to happen here? How vulnerable is Israel to simply having to acquiesce to world opinion, whether or not it's strategically or morally right for them to stop what they're doing or change what they're doing in light of it?
Look, I you know, I'm not the Biden administration's number one fan, but I have been broadly supportive. And, you know, I wrote a column after October 7th titled Biden, President Biden's Finest Hour. I read somewhere that Biden's father had a saying that if you're going to nail yourself to a cross, make sure it's a big cross, you know, give yourself sacrifice for a big cause. And I think Biden is doing that and has done that. The $14 billion that he's requested in military aid for Israel, which is almost certainly with a view not towards what's happening in Gaza, but what I think may soon happen in Lebanon, is proof of that. Yeah, it's true that the Biden administration has politics to think about. And there is a large part of the Democratic Party that I think has lost its liberal principles by effectively supporting Hamas against the only state in the Middle East where you'd want to be a woman, where you'd want to be a gay person, where you'd want to be anything that is goes against the grain of the culture and the state. But given his political constraints, I think the president has been fantastic. Certainly a hell of a lot more courageous than what I'm seeing from your average Republican who's sort of preemptively caving to Trump when it comes to Ukraine. I mean, I hate these pundits who are always essentially trying to find fault with the guy or the person they are presumed to oppose. I want any president of the United States to succeed. I want to support policies I agree with. I think Biden has generally been courageous and will be well remembered by history for the position he took, especially because it's going to cost him some votes in places like Michigan.
What do you think Israel should do, and or what do you think they will do with respect to the threat posed by Hezbollah in the north, and how does this not ultimately become a war with Iran, you know, whether by Israel alone or the U.S. and Israel?
Well, first, it is a war with Iran. It's a war with Iran's proxies, but these are proxies the way that you know, the Donetsk People's Army or whatever it was called was a proxy of Russia during the first phase of the Russian-Ukrainian war after 2014. My sense, I hope I'm wrong, is that we are not nearing the end of this conflict. We are in its early chapters because from it, Hezbollah has been trying to keep the war on a simmer in the north. At one point, one of their rockets is going to hit, God forbid, but it's going to hit a school, it's going to hit a hospital, it's going to be a mass casualty event. It's just almost in the nature of these things. Secondly, the Israelis can't accept a situation where you have more than 100,000 people in the north who have been living outside their homes for months now. If you do the math, the number of Israelis who are now internally displaced people, refugees inside of Israel itself, is like the equivalent of 5 million Americans. So imagine if the whole state of Minnesota suddenly had to descend on, I don't know, Chicago and Madison and camp out there for a while. That's the situation the Israelis find themselves in. So Hezbollah is going to miscalculate or just misfire. The Israelis need to restore not only deterrence, but a psychological sense of deterrence on the north. My sense is from talking to people that many Israeli military leaders think that they're better off starting a war on their terms, as Israel did in 1967, rather than what happened in 73 with the Yom Kippur War, the war being inflicted on them. And a war in Lebanon is going to dwarf in terms of the magnitude, the scale, the duration, what we've seen so far in Gaza. Hezbollah is a much more powerful military force, much more deeply entrenched than Hamas is. So we are in the early hours of a long conflict, or the early stages of a long conflict.
Is that the kind of conflict that Israel could shoulder on its own with our support, or would you imagine we would have boots on the ground or our own missiles in the air in that conflict?
I suspect that both Israel and I know America would be very eager for this to be a conflict where it's only Israeli boots at risk. America doesn't have a very happy history of putting troops into Lebanon, for starters.
Yeah.
And also, Israel has a belief that goes very deep into the psyche of the country that they have to be able to defend themselves on their own. I mean, of course, military help, American planes and munitions and so on, but that it's important to the national psyche that they be a militarily self-reliant nation. In fact, I think one of the things that you're going to see happen in the next year or so is that a lot of the stuff that we, the United States, now provides Israel, tank shells, bunker buster bombs, are going to be produced domestically by the Israelis. They're not comfortable with the idea of depending on the whim of a foreign leader, even one as friendly as President Biden.
Mm. What do you think we should be doing to more effectively deter Iran at this point? I mean, you take the Houthi attacks on shipping in the Red Sea. I'm wondering why we haven't bombed the Iranian ports, right, and just brought their oil industry down to zero at this point. I mean, it seems that it's somewhat mystifying that Iran can keep provoking us, you know, albeit mostly through its proxies, to this degree with confident in the knowledge that we're not going to do anything that really harms them.
Yeah, I think it's a shame. Look, you know, it's the scene in, what was the Kevin Costner, Sean Connery movie, The Untouchables, you know, the Al Capone scene where Connery, the tough cop, explains to Costner, the Elliot Ness character, you know, the Chicago way is they pull a knife, you pull a gun, they send one of yours to the hospital, you send one of theirs to the morgue. And the Chicago way is the only thing that gets across to the Iranian regime. This is a uniquely brutal regime. We witnessed that in 2022 as they were raping and poisoning schoolgirls as a matter of policy in retaliation for the protests there. Mm. So yeah, take their oil capacity offline, destroy one of the key nodes of their nuclear facilities, basically send the signal that if you want to disrupt World Trade. If you want to aim your drones or have your proxies aim their drones at American warships, you're going to pay a price that's tenfold. I think that's the language that this despotic regime, the only language they understand. And I think what you're going to see in reasonably, you know, short order is the resumption of attacks by Iranian proxies on American targets. I don't think anyone is particularly eager to get into another major war, given where we are globally. But the only way you actually at least postpone for a long time, if not avoid, a war with Tehran is to whack them so hard that they kind of get the lesson. And proportionate responses are the last way to deliver that lesson.
Okay, well, let's take a few minutes to address those criticisms that you have that you ring fenced in the beginning of this chapter of the conversation. What is the most charitable version of a criticism of Israel and her politicians and politics, her right-wing extremists, etc., which makes them morally culpable for at least part of all of the chaos we've been describing? I mean, what are the failures on the Israeli side, and how do you see them being rectified? I'm thinking, obviously, of some of the people you didn't name beyond Netanyahu, really shouldn't be in the government, and I'm thinking about the settlements in the West Bank primarily.
Sure. I mean, and this is a long list. And by the way, you know, there's this kind of idiot view that any criticism of Israel is anti-Semitic. I mean, you just open an Israeli newspaper and the criticism pours forth. Obviously, criticism is not only not anti-Semitic, it's essential. So, you know, let's go down the list. Number one, Netanyahu's heavy responsibility, culpability for what happened on October 7th, not just because of the criminally stupid judicial reform bill, which divided the country on the eve of the attack, but his policy of effectively funding Hamas or allowing Qatari money to go to Hamas on the presumption that A, Hamas really didn't want to have a major war, but B, that having Hamas in power in Gaza actually suited his political needs because it was a kind of an advertisement against a Palestinian state. So Bibi bears heavy, heavy responsibility, and he should be thrown out of office as soon as the Israeli political calendar allows. Secondly, you know, you have guys like Itamar Ben-Gvir, who used to worship the memory of Israeli terrorists, who was one of the kind of thuggish characters at the edges of the anti-Rabin movement that led to his assassination. Homophobes like Bezalel Smotrich, the finance minister, you know, describes himself, I think, as a proud homophobe or something like that. The only thing that can be said is, you know, if you look carefully at most Western European governments or many Western European governments, they also have some unsavory characters in office. Austria, Sweden, you know, countries that are not constantly being condemned as sort of unsavory right-wing dictatorships have brought in some nasty people because that's, unfortunately, that's democracy. And in Israel, you had about 10% of the electorate voting for parties that were basically fascistic. By comparison, in France, you had 40% or close to 40% of the country voting for Marine Le Pen, who's basically fascistic. And let's not get started on, you know, the United States. So, I mean, I don't say that to excuse people like Smotrich. I just want to put it in a bit of context. Getting to the question of the settlement enterprise, the West Bank, there are a lot of fanatical, nasty, terrible settlers. It is simply false to paint everyone as one way or the other, but you find very bad characters with racist or bigoted views throughout the settlements. I mean, it's just a fact. What's also a fact is that Israel in 1993 made a sincere and concerted effort to give Palestinians a state. And in the summer of 2000, the Israeli prime minister at the time, Ehud Barak, made an offer that was described by President Clinton as essentially giving something like 96, 97% of the territory that the Palestinians claimed they sought to create a Palestinian state. Might not have been everything the Palestinians had asked for, but we could have had a Palestinian state in its 24th year of life if the Palestinian leaders had simply said yes. They said no because a good portion of Palestinian leadership and also of society isn't really interested in a Palestinian state on the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. It's interested in what they call the whole of historic Palestine, which is to say not the creation of a Palestinian state, but the destruction of a Jewish state. And this was followed, I was there at the time, by a storm of terror. I saw both my neighborhood cafes get blown up. I saw a reporter who worked for me on a bus nearly lose his leg just down the street from where I lived. 3 years of nonstop terrorism. And that was how the possibility of a Palestinian state more or less came to an end, which was Palestinian leaders rejecting the offer they were given. And then instead of trying to go back to the table to negotiate a better deal, starting a campaign of terror.
This is the Second Intifada.
The Second Intifada. Yeah. And I'm only saying this to say that, you know, these simplistic narratives that you hear on college campuses just lack the genuine complexity of a tragic situation in which two people with very different aspirations and goals are contending over some of the same pieces of land. And in a normal, rational society, there should be an avenue for productive compromise. My argument has been that the people who have mainly said no, not only in 2000 at Camp David, but all the way back to 1947 and the resolution that brought Israel into existence, which was rejected by all of the Arab states, has been the Arab side. I'm happy to have an argument about that, but at a minimum, this sort of simplistic view, Israel, settler colonialist enterprise, Palestinians, the righteous indigenous people, is just a bullshit simplistic argument. Jews are the only people in the world who can archaeologically, verifiably trace their ancestry to the place in which they live for not just 2,000, but 3,000 years. If you want to end settler colonialism, if this is the big sin, and you're some white person living in Massachusetts, my strong advice is set a personal example, find out where your ancestors came from, whether it's Norway or France or whatever, petition for citizenship and leave, because the settler colonialist society is as much American, is far more American or Australian or Canadian or whatever, that it is the Jews who actually are the quintessence of an anti-colonial society.
Yeah, I mean, the double standards here are everywhere to be seen. I've pointed out several times before that no one is calling for a right of return for all the Jews who were driven out of Yemen or Syria or Iraq or Morocco or Egypt after 1948. You know, this is not, you know, who's in their homes and when can they get them back? That's not a conversation that's being had in the UN or anywhere else.
And that's what's called anti-Semitism. Chuck Schumer gave a beautiful speech in the Well of the Senate a few months ago in which he said that the heart of anti-Semitism is the double standard. It's always the double standard, which is, you know, after 9/11, America goes and bombs the shit out of Afghanistan, right? And drone strikes in Pakistan and so on. And it's kind of like a shrug. I mean, after all, we were attacked on 9/11, and we're gonna get back at the people who attacked us. By the way, in my view, a perfectly historically, morally legitimate, you know, position to take. But Israel experiences the equivalent of 14 or 50 9/11s, the proportional equivalent of 14 or 50 9/11s on a single day. And the response is, well, the Israelis should show restraint. They should forgo vengeance. You know, there was a philosopher, Eric Hoffer, speaking of Cold War philosophers. Mm-hmm. He once said something to the effect that the Israelis are expected to be the only Christian nation in the world.
Yeah.
And that's the double standard. And that's why, although criticism of Israel is not anti-Semitic on its face by any stretch, but the militant anti-Zionism, which holds Israel to standards to which no other country is held, is anti-Semitic. It's not just about a political difference. It is treating Israel to a set of standards that apply nowhere else, and it's prejudicial and discriminatory.
Okay, moving now to the 2024 election, talking about the problem with with Joe Biden, and whether it's real or merely optical, or whether optics really are everything at this point, taking the case for Trump seriously. I guess you could say something about Nikki Haley, although we'll be releasing this after she's almost certainly lost in South Carolina, so it may be relevant or not. I guess the bridge between the Middle East and the election here is, I guess I'd like to ask you, assuming Trump wins,
God.
I say that with vomit in my mouth and elsewhere, assuming that happens, what would you expect to happen with respect to America's posture in the Middle East with Israel? I guess you could also say, what do you think the implications are for the war in Ukraine? What would happen with President Trump in next year?
Well, I find the idea of a Trump presidency so appalling, not only with respect to what it means for the rest of the world, but honestly, what it says about us as a country. I mentioned earlier, I wrote this long essay in the Times where I thought, okay, there's a value in terms of just intellectual honesty in making the strongest case for Trump that I can, just on the kind of know thine enemy kind of principle. But what does it say about a country that a president who denied the results of the election, who is the most graceless loser of all time, and who egged on a mob to storm the United States Capitol to overturn the results of a Democratic election, that this guy is the presumptive front runner for the next presidency, it shakes my faith in America like nothing else in American history. It shakes my faith in who we are or what we've become as a people, that tens of millions of Americans would go, huh, yeah, okay, well, you know, but he was good in other respects. So that's the first point. To your question, Sam, look, the answer is I don't know, because we don't know what Trump 2.0 is going to look like in relation to 1.0. And some awfully smart friends of mine, Bob Kagan has made this point, have said, A, Trump is going to know how to wield the machinery of government as he didn't the first time around. B, Trumpism as a political philosophy is much more elaborated, if you want to call it a philosophy, but yeah, in a sense it is. Much more elaborated. It has its theoreticians, its practitioners, in a way that he simply didn't the first time around. The Trump administration is going to be staffed not with, you know, patriots who think that they're saving the country from the worst of Trump. It's going to be filled with true believers who want to impose this xenophobic, hectoring, isolationist or neo-isolationist, bigoted version of his politics on the rest of the world. And we're going to emerge from a second Trump administration unrecognizable as a world power from where we were at the beginning of it.
Mm. I forgot how far Kagan took it in his article. I remember reading it, I guess it was a couple of months ago, but it seemed, you know, quite dire in the sense that he, you know, I forget if he landed all the way with fascism or, you know, the complete erosion of our democracy, but it was, if not, it was something close.
Yeah,
are you as pessimistic as he is?
I would have to look at it. I don't want to mischaracterize his argument. Look, there's a counter argument that says Trump, even if Trump wins the election, chances are Democrats hold the Senate, hold one, maybe take the House. It's a federal system of divided powers. There's a limit to even what Trump 2.0 can do. And I hope that case is right. And I hope that we learn again that Trump's bark is usually worse than his bite. But the argument I always made about Trump, this is going back to 2015, 2016, before he was elected, isn't so much that he was going to bring about a catastrophe, although he could. It's the corrosiveness of what he represents. It's that he is a corrosive agent on the glue that holds our democracy together. And by the way, those people who are listening to your podcast who are on the, kind of broadly speaking, on at the center or center right, if you're the kind of listener who doesn't like Trump, but say is sort of thinking that, well, maybe he's not so bad and he's better than that woke left, nothing will do more to revive the ultra woke Antifa left than another Trump administration, because he activates the worst elements of everyone, including in his opponents.
I would say, I have a fairly strong sense that we have achieved peak woke and the pendulum is swinging back. certainly in the aftermath of those congressional hearings with the college presidents bending over backwards to give scope to anti-Semitic mobs on their campuses. But I think that's only true if we don't have a second Trump term. If we get Trump again, I think we get the woke apocalypse all over again.
Everyone is going to be at the barricades.
Yeah.
And it's going to be that much worse because Trump will be that much worse. It's Newtonian physics with every action engendering an equal and opposite reaction.
So I think I cut you off before you said what you thought, what the implications of a Trump presidency would be for Ukraine and Israel.
Well, let's talk about Ukraine first. I think the Trump plan, as I understand it, from talking to people who know stuff, is the idea is starve Ukraine of weapons now. That's why he's opposed to the $60 billion. Put Ukraine in a position in which he's on the verge of losing. Then Trump is elected, calls the summit, and says to Putin, says to Ukraine, okay, this is what you're going to accept. This is the deal. And by the way, Putin, if you don't accept it, then we are going to arm the Ukrainians to the teeth with our best military equipment, and we'll even bring Ukraine into NATO or whatever. And this is the Trumpian plan, as I've heard it, for ending the war in 24 hours, which is what he's claimed he's going to do. Now, you know, of course, this is ignominious and totally stupid because, you know, another year of Ukrainian retreat and there might not be much of a Ukraine to defend. You could see political upheaval in Kiev. You could see all kinds of things happening if Ukraine isn't given the means to defend itself when it's being, you know, heavily attacked on five, you know, separate fronts, when its losses are much greater than we've seen widely reported, even with the fall, you know, of Avdiivka and other places. So it's a terrible scheme that is going to, you know, that has this kind of the usual half-assed surface plausibility, but ultimately is a giveaway to Putin and a signal to other adversaries of the United States that it's open season and that you have a president who's self-infatuated, stupid, and negotiable.
And Israel?
Well, there again, you know, I don't know. I mean, you know, everyone says, well, Trump's pro-Israel bona fides are very good. He moved the embassy to Jerusalem and recognized Israeli sovereignty on the Golan Heights, and he's got his Jewish son-in-law who does, I don't know if this Jewish son-in-law speaks to him now, but who knows. But look, the deeper point about Trump is that A, he has no concept of loyalty, and B, if he has a single conviction, it's an isolationist conviction, and C, he insists on people toadying to him. Now, Bibi Netanyahu was very good at toadying to him, I must say, during 4 years in which they interacted. But I would not, even if I were a one-issue voter and that issue were, you know, what's good for Israel, I would still vote for Biden.
Okay, so what are Biden's political fortunes, do you think, over the next 8-some-odd months?
Terrible. Terrible.
I recently spoke to somebody who felt that that we're being powerfully misled by the polling. They think that independence, that really is a story of what independents are going to do. And at this point, independents aren't answering these sorts of polls. And they put the prospect that Trump was going to win at more or less at zero. I must say, this, as much as I want to believe that, I can't quite let myself. A couple of questions here. One is, what do you think the chances are that the Democratic candidate will not, in fact, be Biden? And what is the path to that outcome, if there is one? And if it is Biden, how concerned are you that he's becoming less and less electable by the hour?
Well, I think the chances that he's not ultimately going to be the nominee are reasonable. I don't want to put a number next to them.
What would you imagine coming about so as to make that the case? Apart from, obviously, if he dies in the meantime, that's going to be the case.
But, or not, God forbid, but you know, Biden falls flat on his face on stage and has a horrible bruise. Something like that, some kind of event that just crystallizes his
infirmity.
Yeah. And people say, well, Trump is also infirm and Trump is also stupid. But the difference is that Trump is energetic in a way that Biden is not. And secondly, people have kind of already priced in that Trump is insane, right? So when Trump says something stupid, you don't chalk it up to Alzheimer's, you chalk it up to Trump, right?
Yeah.
So there's, I mean, like it or not, it's just the I think the reality we're dealing with. Second point, I think last I looked at the Nate Silver poll, Biden's is at 39% approval rating. I can't think of any incumbent ever at this stage in the election who has survived that kind of low approval. I think George H.W. Bush had higher approval at this stage.
Hmm.
And it's compounded by the massive unpopularity of his vice president, who has a 37% approval rate, and where voters are saying to themselves, she very well could be president in a year or two. So it's not as if, like, I mean, if Biden's running mate were, let's say, Admiral Jim Stavridis, the former NATO commander, people would be like, you know, it wouldn't be the worst thing if the president were too infirm and had to be, you know, replaced under the terms of the 25th Amendment, because we get this, you know, very honorable, intelligent, reliable military guy who's going to keep the country safe and do right by us. But instead, his running mate is someone that people see as a lightweight and frankly gives us no reason to think she isn't a lightweight. So that's another thing. Third thing is there are these third and fourth party candidates. And people might say, okay, well, what does Cornel West matter? If you got low black turnout in states that are being decided by narrow, razor thin margins, and some portion of the black turnout going to, say, Professor West, it's going to have potentially devastating impacts. I mean, Georgia was decided by, what, 10, 12,000 votes. We're talking about very small margins. So between the Cornel West run and Bobby Kennedy Jr., that's further bad news. And the final point, I'm sorry I'm going on at such length.
No, I like it.
But the final point here is, I keep hearing this happy talk from Democrats. Well, the economy is getting better and we've put inflation behind us. The economy is getting better, but the idea that we've put inflation behind us is bullshit, because that's not the way people think. Just because prices are not going up at the same rate that they were in 2022 or part of 2023 doesn't mean people aren't comparing their situation today to what it was in the last year of the Trump administration. It's high interest rates. It's a sense that things are much more expensive now than they were 4 years ago. It's the proverbial rent is too damn high, which it is. These things weigh on people, and they particularly weigh on people who are must-win voters for Democrats. Middle class, lower middle class, working class people who have really been harmed by the Biden economy. And I haven't even talked about migration, but that's, I guess, the last point.
Yeah. Well, we can bring that in now. I mean, beyond his age and its obvious neurological consequences, many of us perceive Biden's greatest political liability to be what's happening at the southern border, whether that could be controlled by him or any U.S. president or not. What do you think about what's happening there, and what should we do about it, and what could Biden do about it in the meantime so as to actually remove it as a political liability, or even make it a political asset, given the success of some possible response to it?
Look, it goes without saying that we are dealing with a situation in not just in Mexico, but throughout almost all of the Americas that is nearly unprecedented, and that you have state failures in a frightening number of countries. I mean, Venezuela is a failed state, Honduras. Much of Mexico, my own country, is a de facto failed state.
Let me just remind people of that, because it's not at all obvious in that how you present yourself. Your home city is Mexico City, right?
Yeah, I grew up in Mexico City. My grandparents moved to Mexico in the 30s, and my father was born there and was a Mexican-American dual passport citizen holder. But my formative years were in Mexico City.
Nice.
But at any rate, the point is, yes, you do have this unprecedented challenge of millions of people in desperate straits trying to get to America. You also have the fact that on the first day of his presidency, Biden said, I am the un-Trump. I am doing the George Costanza move of doing the opposite of Trump. And it served as a signal, and this was widely reported in the New York Times and elsewhere, served as a signal to millions of migrants that they could get in here. And we've had something like 7 times the number of the migration figures are like 7x what they were under the Trump years, in part due to policies by the Trump administration that were certainly needlessly cruel and stupid, but nonetheless were restrictive and kept many migrants away. It is not racist to say that America deserves to have a policed, secure, and lawful border, that the people who come in here do so, as my mother did as a refugee, do so lawfully, that there are means to support them, that there's an economy into which they can, you know, where they can become a part. And all of that is being challenged by what essentially was a quasi-open border policy for the first couple of years of the Biden administration. And what was really bad was President Biden and Vice President Harris basically saying, we have a secure border. All of this is much ado about nothing. Migration is seasonal. One excuse after another, giving Americans the sense like, this guy is just not seeing the problem that we are. And that problem only became visible, I'm sorry to say, when Southern governors started shipping migrants north, and all of a sudden on the streets of New York City, you started to see scenes of, you know, Latin American beggars with babies on their backs that I knew from my childhood. It's a huge problem. And Biden did not take it seriously. I'm not sure he still is taking it seriously. I mean, the impeachment of Mayorkas was ridiculous, but Mayorkas should have been fired as his Homeland Security guy because you have a complete failure to enforce the law or gesture even seriously towards a real border policy. I don't want to go back to what Trump is, but we can't have an open society that's open to everything that immigrants so often provide us if it's an open border. It has to be lawful.
What about when you look at the numbers here, it's hard to imagine how order can be put to this chaos, because I mean, you're talking about millions of people. And, you know, the waiting time in the relevant immigration courts is on the order of several years at this point before someone gets their case heard. And obviously, many people just disappear into the heartland and never show up for their hearing. And I've also heard people voice a fair amount of skepticism as to whether or not it's even possible to have a border that is not in some way perpetually open, right? A truly non-porous border wherein we really can know who we're letting into the country, and we can let in precisely who we want and as many as we want and when we want, and really put order to this. I mean, is there any, I mean, you may know much more about this than I do, or not much. I don't know how deeply you've gone into this as a journalist, but what's your sense of the possibility that this is a problem we can't really solve the way we imagine we can solve it?
Yeah, and look, you're never going to get a perfect border policy. People will always get through. Many people come into the United States by getting on a plane, entering legally, and then overstaying their visas. You know, there is a tolerable level of illegal immigration that America lived with basically quite happily for many decades. And there's an intolerable level. I'm not quite sure what the number is between tolerable and intolerable, but we seem to have crossed the threshold. One of the things, and I say this with regret, but I think the idea of building a wall, it doesn't have to be a wall, but smart fences, barriers, making physical crossings of the border more difficult is a good idea. Just because Trump said it doesn't mean that it is evil, okay? It is a way of signaling a more serious and defensible border policy. By the way, I should have said, and some of your listeners might otherwise take me to task, but Republicans are, of course, now complicit in not going for the immigration bill that Senator Lankford of Oklahoma negotiated with his Democratic counterparts. And that's just rank Republican political cynicism that's, you know, inexcusable on all kinds of levels. Still, it has to be said that the bulk of the border crisis happened thanks to this administration's quasi-indifference nonchalance, lackadaisical policy, if you will, towards it. So it's a bipartisan problem, but I think ultimately it falls on the administration for the situation that we have now. Remain in Mexico policies, much tougher penalties, much swifter deportations, massively beefing up security at the border through the National Guard and state police, whatever it is, to make it more difficult to cross the border is smart policy. At the same time, finding ways to incentivize migrants to seek asylum claims in their country of origin by going to American consulates and embassies, upgrading our facilities there so it's a realistic process, is a long-term good solution to the problem. I mean, we don't want a situation which the answer to too much immigration is no immigration. I mean, we are a much better country, overwhelmingly thanks to the presence of new people with new ideas and new energy.
What do you think of the theory, conspiracy or otherwise, that this level of illegal immigration has been not merely tolerated, but kind of covertly encouraged by Democrats so as to guarantee a fresh batch of disproportionately Democrat voting people in the end, right? So you have, this is like some version of the great replacement theory, but it's been explicitly endorsed by many prominent people right of center. I mean, and there are people like, you know, obviously Tucker and even Elon Musk who are just all in on this as being a confirmed plan on the part of the Democrats. How crazy is this allegation, if it is in fact crazy?
I mean, I think it's just false. I see no evidence of some master plan that this is what the Democrats are aiming for. I think many Democrats were horrified, often for good reasons, by the Trump administration's policy, especially when it came to family separation. I think there's a kind of a soft-heartedness on the part of many Democrats to take in the stranger without thinking too much about what exactly that entails or whether there are sensible limits to national generosity. And that has nothing to do with some kind of replacement theory. But by the way, if in fact that's the theory, it's a stupid one because we're seeing year after year a larger share of Hispanic voters supporting not just Republicans, actually supporting Trump. So we may end up in 3 or 4 election cycles getting to a moment when Hispanics become one of the largest voting blocks for the Republican Party. By the way, if you know something about the Hispanic community, they're not always necessarily pleased with unrestricted migration.
Don't you mean the Latinx community?
You know, I think you're pulling my leg, but it's a term I profoundly detest because it's one of these words that woke white people impose on a culture whose very language is a gendered language. Latinos, right. Latinas, but not Latinx. And I don't know of any Latino, any Hispanic, who would ever use that term. It's a kind of a woke imperialism to think that the brainstorms out of Berkeley are what the people of the world demand.
Well, Brett, we've covered a lot of ground, and as always, it's been profoundly illuminating with you. So
I am so honored to be on your show, Sam, because you are at the risk of hyperbole, but I don't think so. I think you're a national treasure, and I'm glad to participate in what you do.
I mean, you and I have not always agreed about everything, and it's just great to have you as
collaborator
here,
right? Yeah. I mean, what's the point of agreeing about everything?
Yeah.
And probably I was wrong.
I know you. I'm thinking of one instance where you were all too right, which I've already. I already gave you a public apology here for.
All right, really, it's an honor to share this virtual stage with you.